Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Today you've been hearing a panel discussing Manning Marable's new biography of Malcolm X, recorded at the Enoch Pratt Library in Baltimore. The panelists are Michael Eric Dyson, who you also hear hosting his show right here on WEAA every day, Melissa Harris Perry, professor of politics and African American studies at Princeton University and now Tulane University, Sherilyn Eiffel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, and Lester Spence, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Let's go back to our discussion. Let me allow the audience to jump in here now while we have time. The microphone is here to my left. And if you want to identify yourself, that would be great, and ask your question.
My name is Mitchell Ferguson. Fred Hampton used to always say, get the people to say, I'm a revolutionary. He would get them to say that over and over and over again. And one of the things that that happened is, and historically, we have diminished that period as them being somewhat misguided, frivolous. And what Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party did was, you know, if that was so diminished and not so powerful, how come they created COINTELPRO and attacked all those people over and over and over again? Because what they did, the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, they did a critique of capitalism. And even our greatest scholars who supposedly been progressive, they don't really do a critique of capitalism. And that's one thing that happened with King when you listen to all their speeches and Malcolm. That's what they started to do when you really, and the evolution was a critique of capitalism. And once you start doing that, that's where the danger happened. And our scholars, our Black scholars, they don't really do that. You know, you talk about Black nationalism and this, but a critique of capitalism is very dangerous.
I'd like to grab that first.
I mean, it's a worthy comment in the context of talking about Manning Marable, whose politics were, I think part of his anxiety about Black nationalism was precisely because he understood his politics rooted more in a Black radical socialist tradition. I will say, and this isn't, I once asked Manning, well, you know, how do we do this? I was a graduate student, and I was trying to get a job in the academy. And one of the most powerful things Manning ever did was teach me how to get what I needed from this institution financially. People don't talk about it at all. They just act like it's, you know, you should just get a job and be happy. And Manning was like, you ask for this, and then you ask for this, and then the next day you ask for this, they don't give you this, it's all right. You go back. And I said, well, whoa, wait a minute. How can I simultaneously ask basically for a contract and have a commitment to questions of economic justice? And Manning smiled that smile that if you knew him, you know. And he says, Melissa, nothing is too good for the working class. And, you know, one of the things that I am reminded in that, and it's a challenge, I appreciate the challenge that you have just offered, because I do think that there is real intellectual danger in our connections to institutions that feed us. And I think that one of the things that Manning's text on Malcolm suggests to us is the ways, I mean, part of the fight, right? The fight that leads to his death with the nation is about having a roof over his head. If Malcolm had had an independent, wealthy, whatever, who could have taken his wife and four children at that point and put them in a home where they could have lived, all of them together, he actually would not have had to fight with the nation theologically, politically, intellectually the way he did. But he couldn't. He literally couldn't afford to live. I think one of the things we also learn sometimes from some of the more critical texts on King, including Dyson's incredibly important book on King, is that, like, he is hustling, he is working, he's giving talks, not because he likes his big voice so much, but because that's what feeds himself and the movement. So I think there's no doubt that we have to simultaneously recognize that we are, even when you're the Black elite, you are working freaking class, because you are for the most part not from, I mean, my people didn't, when they die, there will be nothing right? So you're not intergenerationally wealthy like so many of your scholarly peers. You may live in a big house, but you have a mortgage on that sucker, right? So there's this way in which, on the one hand, we are simply structurally positioned different than many others, but at the same time, need to continue to engage in an economic critique that fits with our political, gendered, social one, but it can be difficult. So I appreciate the comment in part because it just reminds us of precisely the work that I think Malcolm and Manning were both up to.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
And that's one great. Of the things it points to, so we now really study and are able to get a certain cachet to studying racial inequality, right? But if you were to go to Hopkins and look at their history syllabus, for example, to see what they teach, I'm willing to bet you wouldn't find anything on labor history. If you were to go to Morgan, do the same thing, you wouldn't find anything on labor history. Political science doesn't have a class on class politics, even though I teach the class on racial politics. So I think what we have to do is, in some ways, those of us who are in the academy who were the beneficiaries of Manning's work, what we have to do is start to re-educate ourselves to really deal significantly with class. And I say that as somebody with black nationalist leanings. That's something that's incredibly important, both interracially but also intra-racially. That is, we have to begin to understand and really work with the way class plays itself out in black communities.
And I think that those are brilliant points. I hope you really hear them, because those are very important points. And I just would simply add, to piggyback on what Professor Harris Perry said, Martin Luther King Jr. had to borrow money from his daddy to pay his taxes because he was giving so much of it. The reason I think he's the greatest American, and Malcolm X along in that same, certainly in that same cohort, is because the level of sacrifice was mind-boggling. And like Brother Professor Spence said, you got five kids, you're thinking differently, and you can understand his wife. She's been positioned as a kind of shrew and hag, but she's got to take care of the kids. Martin Luther King Jr. left her in the hood when he finally bought a crib, 1965, 2.5 years before he died, because he had gone to India and believed that people shouldn't own property. So when you start talking about, you know, the radical, King was a true radical and believed not in possessing personal property. But look, he borrowed money from his daddy for taxes, and he's Harry Belafonte has taken out a $100,000 policy, life insurance, on each of his five kids. This is what Professor Harris Perry is saying. So if Malcolm had a benefactor, if he had been Langston Hughes, so to speak, and could get some of that white Harlem dough, then he would have had a different perspective. So even as we deconstruct capital, the point of Karl Marx's deconstruction of capital didn't mitigate against existential assertion of the value and worth of capital. Because when the dude tried to marry his daughter, Karl Marx said, "Can you take care of her?" Karl Marx said that. Das Kapital. Can you take care of my daughter? So I believe in IRAs, individual reparations accounts. And I believe in IRAs, individual reparations accounts. And I think you can't give it to great-great-great-great-grandpa, but you can redistribute wealth towards some of the contemporary people who are inheriting their ideas, but it makes it more incumbent upon us to press the argument forward and to tell the truth about the suffering of the masses who don't even have the quandaries we have because they don't even have a wage, they don't even have a salary. So when we deconstruct it, let's not talk about obliterating or eviscerating wealth, let's talk about its equitable distribution. I think that makes a big difference.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, good evening. My name is Dekon T. I'm originally from West Africa, Liberia, and I'm a middle school math teacher, and I say that to say that I've been in this country for about 20, 25 years. I went to school, Baton Rouge, Southern University, an all-black school. Very proud of that experience, and I did not read Alex Haley's account of Malcolm X. And I think just by osmosis and being around people, listening to the Mark Steiner show, I think I know a lot about it. But I would like to pose 2 points. One is I kind of quietly question the relevance, of black nationalism as it was practiced in the '60s. As is it still relevant to have all these attributes, you know, to be put out there. And if you've read Manny's book, As a Black African, you know, what's the universal truth that I can take from that book? Because you know, I think, you know, it has a story that is not just, you know, an African American story. So, you know, what would be that universal truth, you know, that I can take from it? Thank you.
You should take two or three. I was going to say you should take two or three questions and then let's put them up.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
why don't you do a couple?
Well, then we're, let's tackle this first, though.
Okay.
Let's tackle this question.
All right. Nah, Black Lives Matter is totally irrelevant. You know, just tossing. No. Here's the deal.
In the interest of
right?
time.
So, being brief, at its best, for me, what Black nationalism is about is finding best practices, best cultural practices that we can use to develop the tools to reform and reshape our identity and the spaces in which we live in a way that's humane and works best for Black people, and that can in turn serve as a set of practices or a kind of a body of work that can be used to change America in general. So I would actually say that there is more of a need now for Black nationalism than even in the 50s, given kind of the changing way we understand Blackness and race.
I would only have to ask that you define the terms.
I was going to say, I mean, so, you know, Lester and I have been having this fight about nationalism and feminism for a decade, so we don't have to replay this at the moment. But I would say that I guess I could agree that those are the best aspects of it. For me, the most dangerous aspects of it are the extent to which nationalism then polices the boundaries of Blackness. So in making that claim about what's good for Black people, it then determines who are the appropriate Black people for whom something should be good for. And so what so frequently happens in practice, if not in theory, right, is a policing out of queer identities, of women, of the claim by our colleague Kathy Cohen in her brilliant book, The Boundaries of Blackness, is that one of the reasons that the Black church is so slow in mobilizing around the HIV crisis in Black communities is because it required a focus on those elements of the communities that were considered disreputable, i.e. drug users, those who were gay men, those who may have other kinds of sexual practices that people had anxiety about. And so because the civil rights movement had been so fully engaged in making a claim on citizenship based on the respectability of Black people, right? So we deserve to be citizens because you are misunderstanding us. We're actually, you know, Bill Cosby, right? So what it didn't leave room for was, but you have the right to be a citizen even if you're not Bill Cosby, right? So you have a right to health care even if you are practicing these disreputable practices. So I think that on the one hand, nationalism at its most broad is a core love for Blackness and Black people, a preferential option for Blackness, which so doesn't exist that having a preferential option for Blackness that appears in everything from, like, who you go buy your car from when you walk into the dealership and you're like, the Black guy, because you figure even if he's cheating you, at least then the cheating is going to a Black guy, right? Right, so there's all these, like, or saying, no, actually don't want to live in the white neighborhood. You know, preferential option for Blackness in a variety of ways. But the danger is that it can also limit what we think an appropriate Blackness is. And in certain ways, I think Manning's book on Malcolm does that, in that it's trying to retain Malcolm X as the core leader of African American politics at this moment and simultaneously deconstruct who we think this Black body is and suggest to us that it is more challenging, more difficult, more complex, and more at the boundaries of its own Blackness than we would typically allow it to be in our mythology.
Real quick, we disagree on Black nationalism. We don't disagree on Black feminism. Right. So
no, we do. In that you said nationalism was the most important thing we need.
Okay. So I'd say it's a tie. Easy way to deal with that.
Madam, go ahead.
Mike looks like,
hello. Thank you so much. I really appreciated listening to all of you guys on the panel this evening. So thank you for being here. My name is Aida Rashid. I am originally from California, but I've been in Baltimore for about 7 years. I'm an alum from Morgan State, and I'm actually an artist, but I have a love for humanity and life and understanding people's stories. So that's what brought me here this evening. But my grandparents left Catholicism and went into the Nation of Islam. And then my father and mother embraced Islam. I guess after Elijah Muhammad died, his son, Worthy Muhammad, came about, and I am a product of that. I lived in Africa as a young girl. My father studied Arabic and then moved back to the country, and now I'm here living my life as a young Muslim woman in America. And so one of the things that I find interesting is that story of black nationalism and how I'm a part of that, but then to understand the Honorable Elijah Muhammad not only produced Malcolm X, but a Muhammad Ali and a Louis Farrakhan. And so these are like pretty significant figures in our times today that we all sort of look to. And I'm curious to know from the panel how you guys look to see how Malcolm was directing the black community to essentially Islam, I guess, and which when I say Islam, it's Arabic for al-Islam means the peace. And so I'm curious to know like how you guys feel about that and how Malcolm, I feel like as a young Muslim in America, how he was directing African Americans to understand Islam, to study it, and to understand the understanding of jihad, which means struggle in Arabic, but it means struggle, and how we all struggle, and we all have our personal struggles, but it's really within. It's not about pointing fingers and saying this person is harming me, but we really have to do the work on the inside. So it's a pretty broad question, but I'm very curious to know what you guys feel about. Mainly the question is, how do you feel about Malcolm leading the black community to learn and understand Islam for its essential
Now we're like well, you know, my wife was in the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad, right? As a young girl, she was 16 years old and had left Catholicism, or was on her way. I get it confused. I know she was under Catholicism, and then under the Nation of Islam. It was reading Malcolm X's book, had it snatched out of her hand, and was reprimanded, and then taken to Elijah Muhammad himself. And I said, "Wow, that's that story could have turned out differently, in many ways that I don't even want to speak on." So I begin there by for the reason that. Now, as a mature, brilliant minister and social activist, she is, not me. Mature minister and brilliant social activist who passed through Islam and through Catholicism and through Christianity. No, she's still a Christian, but a post-Christian Christian, so to speak. You know, it's very interesting to me to see that the marks on her life that I've been able to discern and understand have been extraordinarily positive and edifying. So Malcolm X, when I think about Malcolm directing black people toward Islam, I think about Marcy and millions of other people who have subscribed and held fast to the faith. The problem, of course, is not in Islam, in its theological verities that it produces, in the same way as Christianity. It's in the practice of it and the perversion of it by people who done messed it up. And so I think that Malcolm X's ambition, moral ambition, cannot be distinguished from what he learned from Elijah Muhammad at his best. Muhammad did produce a Malcolm X, a minister Farrakhan from the Episcopalian Church in Boston, and then, of course, converted. And, of course, Muhammad Ali. And Ali made the choice of staying with the Nation of Islam when Malcolm X departed. And I got a chance to speak to Muhammad Ali later, and he said he should have, you know, he should have been much more open-minded. I say all that to say, to be brief, that that it's the ideals and the theologies and the moral verities are great, and I think what Malcolm did was about love of black people. I'm going to say something here as a Baptist minister. To me, it transcends your Christianity and your Islamic faith, because there are some Christians who claim they know Jesus who are doing some crazy stuff that I don't agree with at all. So I'd rather side with people who claim to be atheists, but who are doing the work of Allah or Jesus or the Bhagavad Gita or the Holy Quran or the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Whatever book establishes the predicate of your faith, beautiful. But I think in the end, here's where I, ironically, even though I've tried to be critical of many elements of the fascist dimensions of black insular thinking, and the way in which, as Professor Harris Perry says, that it polices the boundaries of blackness, you want us all to be together, and then you say, but except these kind of people who are black. Well, what the hell are you talking about? We all can't be together if you're talking about except the gay people or the lesbian people. Either all of us going to be together, cantankerous diversity in the midst of a mythology of unity, what they used to call operational unity from black nationalism in the 1960s, or it means nothing. And ultimately, my blackness and my religion have converged into love. And I think that the love in the ultimate sense, that unless we can embrace and love blackness at every instance of it, not that we're not critical of the ways in which it has problematized our humanity. So I think if Malcolm was doing something that was helping black people, cool. If Martin Luther King Jr. was doing stuff to help black people, cool. But I think ultimately it must help us become more humane in the midst of our struggles. And anything, religion included, that interferes with the process of radical dissemination of love at the instance of our existence or in community is antithetical to humans and, I think, ultimately to God.
The only other thing I would say is, and I'm glad that, you know, if we're on personal testimonies. There was this important opening of, I think, the black mind in the late 50s and through the 60s that had a lot to do with the civil rights movement, and it would be really a mistake for people not to understand the significance of Malcolm X and actually the movement of the rise of the Nation of Islam as part of that opening of the mind. So I had two sisters who joined the Nation of Islam in the late 1960s as well. Now, this was shocking. This was, we were raised in a very Christian family. This was extremely shocking. And yet, what came out of it was a kind of respect, it made us curious. It didn't shatter the love and the relationship in for something that, you know, we didn't really know very much about. What we knew about the Nation of Islam, we knew because of Muhammad Ali and because of Malcolm X. That's what we knew. We didn't have any other markers within our community to tell us something about the Nation of Islam. And those two things that we knew, Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, were regarded as positive. So it created this opportunity, it created this door through which we did begin to open our minds and we did begin to open our ideas about the range of black experiences that were out there. What's disturbing today, I don't know where the sister is with the question, what's disturbing to me today is that post 9/11 and the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we had an opportunity to further that opening of our mind. It was actually the blast was to, you know, should have opened our minds. The horror of this thing should have opened our minds and should have made us ask questions and should have made us listen for real answers. And there was a brief moment. There were about 2 weeks when I thought it was going to happen. And then it didn't happen. And in fact, it has really closed the American mind tight in many ways, particularly about Islam and the very things that you were just describing in asking your question.
And so this is a moment in which, you know, in reading this book and reading about the Nation of Islam and reading particularly about Malcolm's journey after his Hajj and his feelings about Islam and how it really centered began to center his ideas about who he wanted to be and the contribution he was trying to make, really just kind of calls to mind this very disturbing moment that we're in right now, where this is precisely what we need, is to do exactly what the examination that Michael Eric Dyson says that we need to examine, which is about trying to find this essential quality about love that unites this piece. And yet this is the very moment in which we're just saying, no, I won't, no. We know that that's the way. And yet there seems to be this willful desire to turn away from it. And so it's very poignant reading about Malcolm's journey as a Muslim in this book at the precise moment that we're in this kind of field of darkness and disinformation about Islam.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Today you've been hearing a panel discussing Manning Marable's new biography of Malcolm X, recorded at the Enoch Pratt Library in Baltimore. The panelists are Michael Eric Dyson, who you also hear hosting his show right here on WEAA every day, Melissa Harris Perry, professor of politics and African American studies at Princeton University and now Tulane University, Sherilyn Eiffel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, and Lester Spence, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Don't go away. We'll be right back to continue our tribute to Manning Marable, a look at the legacy of Malcolm X. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back to The Mark Steiner Show. Today you've been hearing a panel discussing Manning Marable's new biography of Malcolm X, recorded at the Enoch Pratt Library in Baltimore. The panelists are Michael Eric Dyson, who you also hear hosting his show right here on WEAA every day, Melissa Harris Perry, professor of politics and African American studies at Princeton University and now Tulane University, Sherilyn Eiffel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, and Lester Spence, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Let's go back to our discussion.
Given the lateness of the hour, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take Professor Eiffel's earlier suggestion right now, and we're going to take the next three folks in line there, each to make a comment, and we'll see what time we have left, okay? So we're running up to the end of the clock, so go ahead, sir.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I've really enjoyed everything I've said thus far. My name is Michael Lindsay, and I'm a lecturer at Morgan State. And being a lecturer, I primarily teach freshmen, sophomores. And what I discovered as far as when this book came out and picking it up and first opening it and wanting to bring it to my class, I actually took it to one class. But what quickly came to me was that I was teaching young people who only have the Spike Lee version of Denzel Washington type of cinematic version of Malcolm X. And it was hard to have a what I'll call a complex conversation, you know, about the book when there was little to no prior knowledge. As stated before, I can get rid of the Spike Lee Malcolm X, the Alex Haley Malcolm X. The question is, to a generation that doesn't even have the Alex Haley Malcolm X and only has the Denzel Washington Malcolm X, how do you believe this book will play into the younger people coming up learning Malcolm X for the first time, period?
That's a really good question. Let me get the other guy. I think we can tie these things together.
Yeah.
So go ahead. Ma'am, go ahead.
My name is Kachobi, and I'm an educator here in Baltimore. My question is very similar to the gentleman who stood before me. I just want to preface my question with the following. On the way over here, my children and I took the light rail, and we saw about five young black male teenagers being questioned by the police, MTA police, that is the transit police. And what bothered me is that four of them were let go, but they had one sitting on the ground, and he was told to keep his hands behind his back. He actually, at the point of being asked to stand up, stood up without any kind of smugness, and he followed all of their, you know, commands, so to speak. Raise your hands, let me frisk you, all of that kind of thing. I say all of that to say that I am one who totally embraces Alex Haley's interpretation of Malcolm X's life. I say that as one who has not read Mr. Manning's book on Malcolm X, but I fully intend to. But I just ask you scholars, you teachers, what is the message that this current work what is the message that this current work will bring to our young black males that Alex Haley's work has not brought to it?
Very good question. Sarah in the blue shirt.
Hi, my name's Alex. Malcolm X has meant a lot to me since I read it in high school. I read it right when the movie came out, and it was a really big deal in my school. Never heard of him, and if he can hear me, I just want some respect to go to him. It's amazing. But I had a three-part kind of comment, I guess. One, it seems to me that with seeing the failures of a great leader, it's almost like us growing up and seeing our parents differently. Mm-hmm. Like, we see our parents as heroes, then we see their failings, and all of a sudden we just want to rage against the world because they're not what we thought they would be. And then in the end, we kind of piece it together and realize that's what makes them great. The second part is, I think, a key to Malcolm X and to what you're saying about how his story unfolded was that his story is it's all marked by conversion. He converted to the Nation of Islam, and therefore, doing that, he had to create a narrative of conversion. I was once this, now I'm this. And so that even makes it even harder when you're talking about autobiography, because he would keep reinventing that as he goes along, you know, because he was inventing his story to go with the conversion. I think being Muslim is a big part of who he is and a big part of what makes him challenging for everyone. But I also noticed that Malcolm X becomes more and more alienated as he goes along, because he challenges life, he challenges politics, and people go, oh yeah, you did great, but he keeps going and keeps challenging. He goes to another country. One, he becomes Muslim and becomes even separate from the people he's around. Going to another country, all of a sudden becoming different from other Americans around him. It seems like he's a life of increased alienation, that in a way it's strange that he was killed by African Americans, just like Gandhi was killed by Hindus.
Let me ask a quick question before we let you all close out the evening and respond to all of this. Is it just you left?
Yeah.
Well, then get up there. I'm sorry. I thought there was a whole line. It would be unfair to leave you sitting there all by yourself.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Cool. My name is Davon Love. I'm a student at Towson University. My question is, because there's been, you know, discussion kind of briefly about black nationalism, and I guess my question is it possible to have a formulation of black nationalism that addresses some of the policing that goes on in some of what Dr. Dyson refers to as the fascist elements of insular black thinking? Is it possible to have a notion of black nationalism that addresses that policing? And how does Dr. Marable's book, how does his portrayal of Malcolm X help in that conversation of the policing of the boundaries of blackness and black nationalism and its potential as a framework for political advancement of black people in this country?
Okay, great. Thank you. So let's tie these things together.
Well, I think I wanted to go to the question that the woman asked who saw the people on the light rail, and it actually reminds us of the earlier question I think we didn't answer about the theme that comes out of the book. And I'm not one to give people universal themes out of books, because I think that's part of the fun of reading it, is that you discover it yourself. But I take the question, I think I understand what you mean by the question, and also about what I hear is maybe a little bit of anxiety about Malcolm with clay feet. And so I want to say a couple things. One is I'm very happy to hear the gentleman say that your children will later realize that's why you're great, because right now that's not happening with my kids, so I'm hoping that that's going to happen. It's wonderful news. But I do think that, I understand the anxiety. I don't think we should, because we're in this room tonight and because we are admirers of Manning Marable, pretend to ourselves that Alex Haley's Malcolm X is going away anytime soon, or Spike Lee's. First of all, they should not. Autobiography of Malcolm X is a brilliant book. It should be read because it's a brilliant book. And it tells a story that is powerful and tells us many things about what it means to be black in America. It's an important, it must be read. It is a seminal work. That's not going to change because we learn more details about Malcolm's life that make him more human, or because we learn his failings and so forth. Letter from a Birmingham Jail, written by Martin Luther King, is no more diminished, nor is the I Have a Dream speech or the April 4th, 1967 speech, because we know that he had extramarital affairs or whatever. Like, that, this just doesn't work that way. Do you know what I mean? There is... And we do have to open our minds to that. And I would suggest that, you know, we follow the example of what white America does with its heroes. And no, I mean this seriously. I mean, we know a lot about George Washington, for example, that we probably didn't know when we were little kids. We knew he chopped down the cherry tree, he was the father of the nation, and so forth. At some point, you know, we've learned more. You read Andrew, you know, Wysenek's amazing book about, you know, George Washington and his slaves. It's worth reading. People didn't stop calling him the father of the nation. People didn't stop saying that he was a great man or a founder. We still have miniseries to John Adams and all, you know. So one of the problems, I think, is we get so nervous about our own leaders and the requirement that they be perfect, even as other portions of the American public recognize the complexity of their heroes and refuse to allow their essential greatness to be diminished. So I have no problem maintaining what I think is a truth, which is Alex Haley's Malcolm X. That's a truth, particularly because it has all of the pieces that were talked about, that it's shaped by the time, it's shaped by Haley, it's shaped by how Malcolm wants to think of himself. All of that to me is relevant to understanding who this man is. The Spike Lee movie, it's a damn good movie, okay? And although it is not a documentary, it never purported to be a documentary. And so therefore it does what every movie fictionalized account of a great person does, is that it takes liberties. And some of those liberties are greater than others. So I think that those stories are not going away anytime soon. I'm not certain that this is going to be made into a movie, you know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it will be, but I do think that we shouldn't overestimate, you know, how quickly the revision will happen. It's going to take time for people to absorb some of what's in here, and I take it that this, and I think Manning Marable would want that, that this would begin a conversation. Other people will write. Other people will take portions of this and take up maybe looking more at the Nation of Islam and looking more at black nationalism in this period. This is the beginning of a story in many ways, and that, to me, since these are now my closing remarks, is what's great about the book as a tribute to Manning Marable's life. He's not closed something. He didn't write the definitive work that now forever closes the story on Malcolm X. He opened a new story. And that means that his work will go forward and has tremendous life as other people take up different aspects of it and begin to explore it even further.
Michael Eric Dyson.
Amen. I mean, amen, amen, amen. That's just great stuff. That the book should be continued to be read. It's a great book. It's a great story. It's and the shape of moral ambition in America is the shape of story. And, you know, that's why we live in a post-literate culture where people are going to the movies to get their, you know, fix for what novels used to do. Right? Novel is not dead, but it certainly migrated to the screen.
and the way in which people consume information, watching John Daly versus, you know, even CNN, or watching CNN as opposed to reading the New York Times, or reading the New York Times as opposed to the Guardian. So there are various levels at which people consume information, and I don't think we should be elitist about it, even as we're rigorous in our exploration of the ideas there. So I think that, you know, the Spike Lee film is the greatest black biopic made, I would argue. I mean, I know a lot of people, I'm saying, what's deeper than that? And there are like 3 or 4 minute segments in that film when Denzel as Malcolm is doing nothing but spitting fire at white supremacy in a way you wish Obama could do in 4 years, right? And as Professor Harris Perry has already said, we understand what the limitations are. We know why he can't do that, you know. And even though I'm a peacenik, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm interrupting Donald Trump's show so I can announce Bin Laden is dead. How you like me now? First of all, ain't no mistakes allowed. But anyway, at some level, I just got to be straight up black masculinist about that and say, damn, you tell me I'm feckless and spineless and I have no cojones? And now here they are for the world to see. And I don't, you know, that's American Empire, but it's a brown face and a brown body on American Empire. And that's part of the problem. But you got to kill somebody to prove you're American. That's the thing. That's part of it, right, not just somebody, right. But anyway, so having said that, the greatest biopic I think made, the Malcolm X film, and I think that Denzel was robbed big time. And I think Al Pacino got it that year because Pacino had been robbed before for Godfather. So I think that it's important, and I'll answer these final two. This is a great question in terms of Malcolm X as, you know, in terms of conversion. It's true. I mean, the beautiful central element of Malcolm's life is about constantly going from one thing to another, constant conversion, constant rethinking. And I'll tell you what that involves, vulnerability and self-criticism. And a lot of leaders just don't have that. A lot of intellectuals ain't got that. A lot of critics ain't got that. A lot of people, whoever we are, don't have that kind of willed vulnerability and the ability to be self-critical. And ironically, I heard somebody say when the gentleman said that ended up black people killing him, and, you know, maybe, well, even if the state was involved, and one of the things we didn't even get to tonight is that Manning Marable makes very clear that the NYPD knew what the deal was and that state police forces knew what the deal was and didn't warn Malcolm. And why do we find that hard to believe? They didn't warn Martin Luther King Jr. and they liked him better, comparatively speaking, than Malcolm X. So why wouldn't they not warn Malcolm X? But having said that, one of the characteristic marks of blackness is self-sabotage and the willingness to hate other blacks. That's just funky, internalized white supremacy that's spread in blackface. It's the ventriloquist act of white supremacy, black mouth moving, white ideas speaking. Right? So at the end of the day for me, I think that the hatred and self-sabotage that we have internalized and then disseminated is characteristic of what happened to Malcolm and what we must resist in ourselves and others as we treat. That's why I think love is at the heart, and I think Malcolm X embraced that at his best. And I think ultimately what Manning's book can do, it can help, I think, open up a conversation about what black nationalism is and what it should be and what any, not just black nationalism, but any ideology, any politics, any theory that is put forth in the name of people, the litmus test must be, to what degree does it free vulnerable and working peoples who are black, who are poor and whose backs are against the wall, and to what degree does it arrive in their lives as a vehicle of liberation? That's the litmus test at the end of the day, and I think this book will help forward that particular thinking.
Suspense.
The one question that wasn't really answered yet, I think, is the teaching question. I'm going to try to take it in a different way. 1965 is to this generation as World War I was to me and Professor Harris Perry. So if you think about it like that, what we have is not just...
Let him finish.
Yeah, if you think about...
I didn't think you made me older than I am.
if you think about that a second, it's not just about teaching Malcolm, it's about teaching the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, right? I mean, you got people who don't know who Rodney King is, right? So this is, so getting back to the nationalism thing, I want to take another cut at it. This is why we need a set of cultural institutions that can teach our history in a way that speaks both to our past and our present moment, right? Now, it's not just black nationalism that says, okay, gay people aren't black. There are black nationalist churches, but the black church is not nationalist, right? So I would say that it's really about taking that text, using it as part of a much larger body, and creating the spaces where you can take that larger body of text to speak to black people where they are.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's it.
Mr. Harris-Terry.
Okay, so a lot of different things, and I'll try to do this quickly. I was feeling sad as I listened to the story about the young men and the MTA, and part of the reason I felt sad about it is my sense that ultimately this context, talking about a book and talking about a thinker and talking about ideas, is profoundly important and woefully inadequate on that question. I sat at a dinner with a civil rights icon at one point, and we were talking about King and X, and I was talking about the assassination of Malcolm X, and this civil rights leader said to me, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Malcolm X was a common thug who died in a street fight. And I was stunned, and I said, well, but wait a minute. And he says, well, let me explain. Martin changed policy. He said, when you look at what Martin Luther King did, I can show you the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I can show you the 1965 Voting Rights Act. I can walk you through structural changes. Now, I think that there's a lot of reasons that is unfair. But what I do want to take from that difficult moment and the ways I had to process and think about that is that a lot of what Manning gives us and a lot of what we've done tonight is to talk about ideas. And I don't want us to lose that ultimately our notion that that Alex Haley's version of Malcolm X can free the young men on the platform of the MTA is an assumption that what keeps them in that moment of bondage is their belief about who they can be, rather than the set of public policies that make their bodies easily victimized by people in uniform. And so I care about what our young people believe. I'm a mother. I'm a teacher. I care at my core about what we believe. But I do not believe that African-American inequality is primarily a result of lack of imagination on the black people. Which is to say that for me, the critical liberating possibility of black religion, and this is true whether it takes the form of ancestral religions of Christianity or, and I wanted to come back to your nation question just for a second, because I think, you know, one of the things we have not been honest about relative to the nation is that the Nation of Islam is like jazz. If the black Christian church is the blues, then God, I sound like Cornell, but I don't mean it that way. What I mean is that it is an indigenous black institution. Right? So what I mean is that there are very few American theologies, right, that are born here, not imported, right? And the two that actually are here, that exist here, that were born here, are black liberation theology out of slave religion that is about Christianity and the Nation of Islam. Right? So there are two forms of Islam that find their way here, but immigration Islam only finds its home here because the nation exists as an indigenous institution. It's part of what makes that initial slur towards President Obama, Muslim. And then what we know that when they say Muslim, what they mean is N-word, right? We know that those things are linked. And so part of the pain, the absolute pain of the moment of the killing of bin Laden is that we all feel the Jay-Z, ha-ha, Barack Obama, get him, take him, and we simultaneously feel he had to kill Osama bin Laden to do it.
Exactly.
That he had to kill the Muslim to do it, right? That the black president had to kill the Muslim, hoping that, and then the white folks still gave the credit to the white president who ain't around these parts no more for having done it. So we feel that because we know that it was like black people wearing the NYPD hats post 9/11. See, I never felt the moment. Because when I saw black men in the city of New York, while Rudy Giuliani was the mayor, wearing NYPD hats, right, as a reflection of their solidarity with the American state over and against the Islamic terrorists. Okay, so our identities are complex, but the beauty of the nation and the beauty of Alex Haley's Malcolm, which is a faith claim, and the beauty of the Christian God that enslaved people gave us was that they all are about an incredible imagination that is outside of empirical evidence. My great-great-great-grandmother was sold on a street corner in Churchill, Richmond. She never knew anything for herself but slavery, never knew anyone from her except slaves, never expected her children or grandchildren to be anything but slaves, and she believed that God loved her. Why? Why would she believe such a ridiculous thing? There was no empirical evidence that God even vaguely liked or noticed that black people existed on the planet. No, for, like, seriously. And this is why I hate the form of Christianity now that, like, if God loves you, you get a big house and a fine spouse. Like,
prosperity.
Okay, So the whole inherent possibility is that we have always had extraordinary imaginations, and you know what? Grandma died a slave anyway, despite the fact that she knew herself to be a full human being loved by God. So what I know is that Malcolm X's autobiography is this powerful text, but unless you are holding it in front of you when they shoot at you, it is insufficient. It is perhaps important, but always insufficient. So I suppose what I want us to take away from it is that the work that we have to do is structural work. Yes. The ideas are critically important. We need the ideas. I am afraid about our bad ideas. I'm afraid when we have ideas that say the best way to liberate yourself as a woman is to become Betty Shabazz or Michelle Obama and to attach yourself to an important man, and part of what I love about this book is it deconstructs that idea because you realize how much suffering Betty Shabazz experiences even, right? So that we can love her and also not have to tell our daughters to be that. So ideas matter. They matter critically, but then in the end, the fact is, even if I don't want to be Michelle Obama or I don't want to be Betty Shabazz, unless I have equal pay for equal work and reasonable capacity to control my fertility, because one of the reasons that women ended, because they couldn't control their fertility, because there was no ability technically to be able to do, if I don't have health coverage, so I would love for Barack to spit fire to white folks, whatever. But what I'm much more interested in is I can look and see that his housing policy is fundamentally different. I can look, I want spit fire, that'd be hot, I'd like
literally.
It, who wouldn't?
Yeah,
but
literally.
Right? But in the end, I just want us to remember that we cannot save our children exclusively through ideas. We must save them through ideas, but it can never exclusively be ideas. We already knew we were human. We already knew that God loved us. Now we have to take the political work that says, if God loves us, and if I'm a human, then you, as the state, cannot continue to treat me as though I am not.
As we close the evening, I want to thank the Marable family for being here this evening. I want to thank and remember Manning Marable for writing this book and who he was as a man and a scholar, Malcolm X, Life of Reinvention, Professor Melissa Harris Perry, Professor Sherilyn Eifert, Professor Lester Spence, Professor Michael Eric Dyson. Thank you all for taking your time tonight. Thank you from all over to be here. Thank all of you for coming tonight. Thank the library for holding it. Thanks C-SPAN for covering it. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.